Welcome to Imagining the Future of Theological Education, a conversation bringing together diverse perspectives on theological education in America today. This podcast series is coming to you from Christian Theological Seminary and with support from the Henry Luce Foundation. I'm Dr. David Malott, president of Christian Theological Seminary, and my co-host is Dr. Deborah Mullen, leadership education consultant and professor emerita at Columbia Theological Seminary. In a series of conversations, Deb and I will be speaking with some of the folks who were part of our study group and other leaders who are informing the future of theological education. We'll chat with faculty and seminary leadership, as well as foundation people and researchers exploring provocative questions related to scholarship, leadership, and theological education. And while our chat will span a vast range of topics, one singular thread will run through every episode, imagining what the future of theological education could and should look like. So welcome to the conversation.
We're really excited to continue these conversations with you, our listeners, and our guests. But we want to start with a little background about how this podcast series came to be. David already mentioned the relationship between CTS and the Luce Foundation, but it was absolutely with gratitude for the grant that we received from the Henry Luce Foundation in 2017 that David and I began hosting a series of consultations across the country on the current and future direction in theological education. And it was actually during these conversations and research that it became clear while institutions face diverse issues, they share a common challenge to think strategically and imaginatively about the future, given the landscape of theological education today. And as you would have it, as the grant wrapped up, we were inspired to widen the conversation in order to share insights we've gleaned with others involved in theological education and how our work is evolving.
Our guests today are Dr. Fernando Cascante, Executive Director of the Association for Hispanic Theological Education, also known as AHTH, in Orlando, Florida, and Dr. Sarah Drummond, Founding Dean of Andover Newton Seminary at Yale Divinity School in New Haven. Today we'll be discussing community-based models of theological education, including the rich tradition of Bible institutes, and how the new ATS standards could foster innovation and greater hospitality and equity. Welcome, Fernando and Sarah.
We've been looking forward to this conversation with you. Let's start with a question to Fernando. What is the unique contribution of Bible institutes and other community-based models of theological education to the future of theological education that is more equitable, inclusive, and hospitable to persons of color?
Well, first, let me say that I really appreciate the opportunity to be part of these conversations and having been part of the whole project of current and future trends of theological education until now. Before I answer the question, let me say that for those who are listening may not know that over 100 years, Bible institutes of all kinds, based on churches, based on denominational programs, even some of them, the shadow of a seminary, and some just by the initiative of leaders within congregations, has served the needs of leadership within the Hispanic, Latino, Latina churches. So we have in our database in AHTH over 300 Bible institutes that we have studied and surveyed, and we can say that they are the main way by which pastors and leaders of congregations are trained in our communities. And they have existed. We have those who are 20, 30, 40 students. We have some who are over 1,000 students. But I will say that all of them carry some characteristics that I think may be important for models that look for more equitable and inclusive and hospitable ways for people of racial ethnic minorities. And I will say 5 words, and then I will briefly explain them. Accessibility, adaptability, affordability, contextuality, and somehow encompassing all of them, missionality. By accessibility, I mean that usually Bible institutes are close to the people they serve, and I mean geographically close. My own experience of going to seminary was that I was able to take a bus and go there. So people cannot be unrooted from the actual locations where their families live and where they work. And of course, accessibility today means that not just geographically, but today with the virtual capabilities that technology provides us, we make sure that people can access what the programs can offer. The other characteristic that I was mentioning was adaptability. And by this, I mean that usually Bible institutes comprise students that are from different academic levels. I myself have taught in courses in some Bible institutes where you will find a doctor, a lawyer who is part of a congregation, studying with somebody who works in construction, a cleaning house lady, all of them together. And Bible institutes have been able to adapt their requirements to work with all those people, sometimes at the same courses. And so requirements are really something that they try to adapt to the realities of students. And the other thing is schedules. One reason I was able, for instance, to go to myself to a seminary because not only was close by, just taking a bus, but they put all their core courses during the evenings when people can go or during weekends. And of course, this is nothing new for some seminary programs today, but it was the professors who took the time and put the schedules to the service of the people they were teaching. The other is affordability. We need to make affordable the courses to our people. And usually costs are thought of not in terms of institutional needs, but the needs of the people who need to take the course. And of course, this is a challenging issue when economic downturns affects every aspect of a theological institution. But still, it's very important that students can afford the courses within their possibilities. The other thing that is important is contextuality. Usually the curriculum in Bible institutes are geared not to make expert or academics out of the students, but people who have deep and serious biblical background to serve the pastoral needs. And in that sense, contextuality, we mean that courses are usually targeted, tailored to the needs of leaders and pastors in their immediate communities. And they try to adapt to the socioeconomic cultural realities of the students. And I think this is important. And finally, I would say missionality. And I know this word doesn't exist in the dictionary, in the English dictionary. But missionality, it is very important because all these aspects, accessibility, adaptability, affordability, and contextuality are based on a perspective of mission. The institution is for the sake and service of the students, their pastoral needs, and also for the sake of God's reign in the world.
Fernando, I'm wondering if you might share a little bit about how the current moment with the move toward online education, how that's interacted with the Bible Institutes. I know institutions across the country are, some have already been online for a long time. Others are struggling. Others are figuring it out. What are you hearing? What are you learning from Bible Institutes at this current moment?
Yeah, well, that's an area we are searching or surveying. I started to survey. I just yesterday had a conversation with the director of a district of Bible Institutes in South Florida. And she was saying how difficult it has been to try to start programs in the online format. She didn't go into the reasons for it, but she was saying that it was finding very difficult for people to get on board the accessibility, and usually online, and having the equipment that is necessary, having the speed of the internet that is necessary, and even just having the experience of working online. Many of our people don't have emails in some areas. And so how do you work online with some people? So online is being an area that many Bible institutes are having an issue. But there are others who have been working with webinar type of courses, online courses. So we have a mix of that. But I would say that the majority is still struggling to get on board with the technology and the software and the skills that are necessary to really start and do the work fully online.
I'm curious, just to follow up a little bit in a different direction. I don't want to assume that the mission of Bible Institutes is to be a feeder for theological institutions, for instance, that we are more accustomed to perhaps as listeners on this podcast. But there is a relationship, I imagine. There is a pathway. Could you say a little bit about that?
Certainly. Some years ago, we started with ATS, a project that is now fully active. It's a project of certification of Bible Institutes, in which together we established some standards that educational and institutional standards, somehow mirroring the standards of ATS, that under certain standards, Bible Institute can work, that will help them, one, improve the quality of the programs they're offering to their leaders and pastors, but also to open a pathway for those who want to pursue and have the skills and academic drive to pursue master level programs. And there is a good number, and we have a very few number of students who have graduated from Bible institutes who are now not even because the certification, what it does is to establish baccalaureate equivalence. And so with that, these students graduating from these Bible institutes can be accepted if schools want to into master level programs. Now, one thing I will say is that within our understanding of theological education, we don't see theological education as a pipeline that takes students from the church to a seminary. We understand theological education being, and here I'm using Dr. Gonzalez's image, like a garden hose, in which the water is not just going from one end to another, but it's just spreading water all over the place in the garden. And so theological education is something that should come in all directions. And so it is important to water theological education through all the levels in which people need training, local congregations, Bible institutes, denominational programs. And that's the way we understand theological education, not a pipeline, but a field, a hose waters the whole area.
That's a powerful image, that switch from a pipeline to drip line to kind of irrigating the community, I think is really a potent and powerful image. Sarah, I'm interested in hearing a little bit about your take on the relationship between Bible institutes and ATS. But before we get to that, it's all part of a larger conversation around redevelopment of the ATS standards. People should know that you were the chairperson for that remarkable task force that reached its completion this summer. A really extraordinary work. We can't thank you enough for that. And we're wondering kind of what you learned in that process of redeveloping those standards for the 270 plus member schools, and maybe even along the lines of how do you see the standards as making theological education more accessible and more equitable, and even making room more for relationships with Bible institutes and other community-based programs?
Thanks, David. And thanks both Deb and David for inviting Fernando and me to be part of this conversation. It's fascinating to look at the question of the future of theological education from a lot of different angles. And I think you have two people on the line who are looking at theological education, perhaps from different points of view, but also with tremendous hope and excitement for what the future might hold. So I don't think either Fernando nor I could ever be called a doomsday cynic. We really believe that God is up to something and something new is breaking forth in the work of theological education. So in order to answer your question, David, about the ATS and the redevelopment of the standards and procedures for accreditation, I want to take a big step back and offer some definitions, in part because there might be some listeners to this podcast who don't swim around in this language all the time, and also in part to share with you what I think I learned when it comes to my own assumptions, of which I really hadn't been fully aware about what theological education is and should be, that were plainly uncovered to me, particularly through the redevelopment process. So in Justo Gonzalez's book on the history of theological education, we get a glimpse into how recent the connection is between degree program learning and theological education. In 2018 or 19 years of theological education for ministry, the amount of time that's been dedicated to learning through what would be considered a classically Greek or a Germanic interpretation of a Greek ideal of what theological education is really only occupies about one of those 21 centuries. So when we say things like theological education for ministry has always been ... we need to correct ourselves immediately and say it is very recently been in a particular way. Second, education for religious leadership takes place in, one might guess, dozens of different ways, even in North America. There's lay theological education for adults in congregations that can be of tremendously high quality. There is theological education for children in Sunday schools and in religious schools that substitute for public education in the life of the child. So when we're talking about degree program-based theological education, we're really only talking about two among dozens of forms, and we're only talking about a nanosecond if we consider the hour that has been the Christian movement. So with that, accreditation, how it works, is that different kinds of schools form professional organizations among their peers. The peers articulate what quality means and together come up with a set of statements about what quality is and should be, that toward which schools should aspire. Those peer evaluators create those standards, and then other entities interpret those standards in a way using them as a bridge to translate whether quality is or is not happening. So accreditation is something that all schools that are recognized by the U.S. government and the Canadian government require in order to be treated like a public entity that can be a public charity, for example, that can receive in the U.S. context federal financial aid. There are certain standards toward which agencies expect theological schools to conform. And that's where the Association of Theological Schools, or the ATS, accreditation comes in. Now, the Association of Theological Schools is a bicameral institution. One of that camel's humps is an entity dedicated to leadership development, which Deb has served on the board so faithfully in for a long time. So the qualities of theological education and how those qualities might improve is really the work of that dimension, which is just one of two parts of the Association of Theological Schools. The other part is the Commission on Accrediting. So if you were to really narrowly define the work of the Commission on Accrediting, you'd say that it's in the business of quality control and truth in advertising. How are we sure that this school is doing good things that are relevant to the North American cultural context? And how can we make sure that they're actually doing what it is they say they do? So the standards of accreditation are meant to articulate this is what good theological education is, and these are the safeguards that need to be put in place so that when a school either fails in quality or is not transparent about what it has to offer, that the students don't end up becoming the sacrificial lamb. So the Commission on Accrediting actually, if you can believe it, carries out in many ways the will of the U.S. government. The U.S. government doesn't have an accrediting body besides the ATS to know whether a school should be eligible for federal financial aid. The U.S. government delegates that authority to the Commission on Accrediting. Without maybe using the same language, a lot of denominations in the Christian movement do the same thing. They delegate to the ATS the quality control work of saying this is a seminary a person could attend and become a minister by virtue of the fact that they have a degree from an accredited school. Not all denominations do this, but some of them do. And some of them do without even realizing what it is they're doing. In the North American context, because so many professional schools, public schools, universities rely on accreditation, they get a bit of a pass. Namely, people say, oh, they're accredited, they must be fine. And the person who says they've been permitted to run a school, they must be fine, doesn't even realize they're doing it. So, speaking of not even realizing they're doing it, I've already said that theological education that takes place in the form of degree granting represents a very small subsection of what theological education really is. And specifically, it applies to freestanding denominational seminaries that have troubled themselves to go through an accrediting process in order, in many cases, to achieve legitimacy in the eyes of the wider public who doesn't even really know that they need that until they don't have it. And then we have the university divinity schools, which are professional schools embedded in entities that are themselves accredited, but where the ATS, the Association of Theological Schools, accredits only the divinity school entity. So again, two forms of schools, the denominational seminary and then the university divinity school, are where accreditation pays attention. So I've also pointed out that the duration of time where the academy, so to speak, these seminaries and these divinity schools have been the majority presence in some corners of the Christian world has been really remarkably a brief period of the overall Christian time. And that degree-granting function was introduced really starting about the beginning of the 20th century, in part just to keep up with the Joneses. As the Industrial Revolution and the modern era unfolded, religious leaders were seeking to compare themselves with leaders in the medical, legal, even educational professions. And in that sense, because they didn't have some societal imprimatur that matched their peers, they invented one. Okay, assumptions. The language of the former ATS standards would suggest that degree-granting theological education is normal, and every other way of getting theological education is abnormal. And until I really delved into the language, asking in what way is this language limiting us, I honestly didn't even notice the ways in which what really is a smaller way, a smaller sector of theological education was being treated as though it was the normative. Much like white, straight, younger, male humans are treated like they're normal and everybody else is different. Just like what Deb and I deal with when people refer to us as women as minorities. Do the math. There's nothing minority about us. Or when you look at Roman Catholicism and the Latinx presence, nothing minority about it. You're using the expression majority to express lodging in the corridors of power and very reluctant to leave. So when I worked with an amazing team on redeveloping these standards, what we committed to was getting out of the mindset that there is a normal way and then another way, especially considering that that which would have been considered normal is the most quickly shrinking area of theological education, which is education in mainline Christianity. So when we got out of that mindset, what we realized is we had been requiring schools that didn't come from a predominantly white institution that had historically educated leaders for predominantly white congregations. We were asking them to seek exceptions just to breathe, just to live out their missions. And I think that a person who looks at our standards that have gone from well over 100 pages to under 50 pages will see that it's not just that we edited. We just came at the work from a very different vantage point. Namely, we moved to a higher level of abstraction where we say virtually nothing about practices and we are obsessed with principles. The principles of high quality theological education could touch any of the strands that I've named, but in the case of schools that seek accreditation, they have to attend to those principles and they have to tell us how they're doing so, show us that they're doing so, and then we need to make sure that they're doing what they say.
It strikes me that that's a pretty radical departure, right?
I mean, radical, much more radical than the members seemed to understand.
That's correct.
I'm not saying that we were trying to be sneaky and subversive, but can you imagine? So I'm at Andover Newton Seminary, which is a freestanding denominational seminary, which is embedded in a university. Interestingly enough, I think that Yale Divinity School, when it goes through its self-study process, is going to have to articulate why it does what it does in a way that it's never been asked to do before. Because the assumption has been, this is Yale. Now, Yale Divinity School is a magical and marvelous place. It will come through that work with flying colors, mark my words. And yet, the work of having to say in words what has been assumed is always disruptive because it means that we're the naked emperor having to look in the mirror and recognize where we might not have sufficient coverage. The classic example when we think about online education is I don't remember a time that somebody has ever asked me to justify why a course that meets with a combination of lecture and discussion is the best way to teach that course. But when we see somebody teaching online, their approach with that naked light bulb and somebody glaring at them, making them prove and justify every pedagogical decision that they make, well, those tables are about to be turned.
Mm-hmm. I remember some years ago, I think it was Dan Alshire said that, you know, the kind of older understanding of accreditation and a kind of the main question behind it to schools was, do you have enough?
Mm.
You know, do you have enough books? Do you have enough students? Do you have enough money? Do you have enough faculty? Whatever that is, that was kind of like, do you have enough? And so clearly you had to demonstrate that you had that. And he said, the new question is, what are you doing with what you have? Which is to your point, Sarah, it's kind of like you really have to explain yourself. So what are you about? How are you doing it? Why are you doing it that way? And what's its purpose? Like, what's your mission? What are you trying to accomplish with these things? And can you do it with a certain amount of integrity? And I think that's a challenge to all of our institutions.
Well, my hope is that it will prompt some really rich conversation. Mm-hmm. It gets the accreditors out of the micromanaging of its accredited institutions. We say about boards, for example, that boards are most effective when they're noses in, fingers out. These standards really do name, this is the value, and you need to tell us how you live into this value, why you live into it that way, and show us evidence that you're doing it. So to use an example that's a little bit more user-friendly than some of the more complex, we say in the ATS standards that good theological education provides ample interaction between professors and students in the classroom. Ample interaction isn't really that vague. My 17-year-old could tell me the difference between a course that is more talking head and more substantive interaction. But the school has to articulate what is substantive about that interaction. And the professor who walks in 2 minutes after class was meant to start, leaves immediately after, lectures the whole time, learns not a single name, isn't delivering. So when it comes to thinking about what impact this change might have on the future, say the future of the ATS's relationship with organizations like the brilliant IF, is that we can have a conversation on two levels. First, IF can use the standards in assessing its own programs because they're really written from a principal's point of view. And second, because of the fact that these standards are written in a way that really decenters the predominantly white seminary that is educating for the predominantly white church, I actually expect that being accredited or not being accredited is going to start to mean something really different. Namely, accreditation in the past has equaled legitimacy. Accreditation in the future is really meant to signal comparability with other institutions with whom you might or might not wish to be compared. So for some organizations, they'll just be better off focusing on the educational resources at the ATS. Because the accreditation side of things is just not something they need to prove that, as Dan Alshire put it, that you have enough. It's not an inventory sheet anymore.
So I'm going to pose to both of you in our final moments together, imagining the future of theological education, what would you like to see?
Well, to piggyback on what just Sarah was saying about two things that at least the standards do, one in particular, is that that it takes the stigma out of other kinds of theological education, particularly when they come from models or sectors that aren't usually appreciated or taken into account or even known. So it is about what you can show and the effectiveness of what you can show, not so much in terms of numbers. So as I see to the future, one of the things that I really think is important is collaboration. Collaboration across that what we call the ecological theological ecosystem, from congregations, Bible institutes, seminaries, and how collaboration can continue, especially now that the issue is not legitimacy, as you just said, but the quality of what we do and the relevance of what we do. So as I look to the future of theological education, I see collaboration as crucial. And collaboration not just within those of us who are similar, but more importantly, because now, as somebody was saying earlier, I think it was you, Sarah, Theological education is happening in Sunday schools, in homes and Bible studies, in Bible institutes and denominational programs. So there is great opportunity, I see, for collaboration, cross-fertilization in that sense. And I would like to see, as we look into the future, more and more conversations, not just on how we can secure the future of my understanding of theological education, but how can we together think of the theological education of the future, of the next 10, 15, 20 years. That requires to be thinking about what are the main organizing principles of our curriculum. Is it a traditional discipline that we have been thinking of for this nanosecond of theological education? Or is it live issues centered curriculums that speak to the immediate realities of people and curriculums being thought of from that perspective, where we're producing materials not to secure a status in the academy, but we produce materials and books and resources for the people that need it anywhere from everywhere? That's the kind of conversation that I would like to see happening as we look into theological education of the future.
I agree with everything Fernando has said, so I won't repeat it, but I will take it in a different but related direction when I say that my real hope for the future of theological education is that we'll move away from a sense of forced assimilation and toward a sense of contextual distinctiveness. So I came of age in the 80s. Now in the 80s, the church of which I'm a part, the United Church of Christ, was already in decline when it came to membership, although we didn't know that. At the time, we didn't have the data points to see it. And it also was a time where we were just starting to realize that expressions like melting pot and expressions like colorblind were maybe not capturing the very best of the North American context. In other words, we were just at the beginning of recognizing that different communities are distinctive from one another. That's not the problem. The problem is calling one normative and another one disordered, and then hierarchizing them, ranking them. That was the problem. But in theological education, I don't feel like we've totally gotten there yet. Namely, I love the idea of the future of theological education being a contextually appropriate mixture with, as Fernando said, a really high level of collaboration. So to use my own institution as an example, Andover Newton Theological School was a freestanding school with no university partner only 5 years ago. We're in now our fourth year as an embedded school, third year if you just look at the paperwork. Now, when we were a freestanding school, we had to do everything. We had to offer the whole curriculum. We needed a registrar and a CFO and a CEO and a CAO, and it was crushing us to try to be a small school with a big campus and the complexity that comes with being a small institution in a highly regulated higher education context. When we became an embedded school, we stripped down all of what we are as an institution to a really narrow, and I use that word cringing, a narrow focus on preparation for ministerial leadership in religious organizations founded in the locally governed style of being church. Now, sounds like a mouthful, and it sounds like a really narrow focus, but it's been delightful to be able to focus narrowly. As for me and my house, we focus on churches where the hierarchies are flat, and what does it take to lead one of those? So one might criticize my argument and say that I'm just wanting a series of theological boutiques that each have one product. And I'm not even sure that that would be an unfair criticism, but I add to it that I think I'd prefer to have a conversation with somebody like Fernando, who's focusing on a context and a kind of learning that's needed for a very particular kind of institution and its mission. And then talk with those whose mission might focus more on the Roman Catholic tradition. I'd rather be in a room with these people, with the three of us, talking about how are we managing the challenges of this incredibly complicated and broken world right here in our context right now and into the future, than to be sitting around with a bunch of people who are fancying themselves generalists, but with very little knowledge of any context but their own. Mm. So I picture this future salad bowl, this future stir fry, whatever food metaphor, but with a great deal of cross-fertilization and learning from one another.
I think that encapsulates very succinctly part of what we discovered in our study, which was theological education was alive and vibrant in a variety of places beyond our institutions that were not necessarily doing so well for a variety of reasons. And we would invariably ask the question, who are you in partnership with? Is there a theological institution? Are you working with them? And invariably, with a few exceptions, what came back was it's just too difficult because of structures and institutional standards that make it difficult for collaborations between like and unlike organisms that are doing theological education. I think one of the things that you've said is that these standards hold out the hope in a way like never before, really, to do theological education that is equitable, where people are compared with like, not just like communities or like things, but the conversation originates from a different place than it did before. You're doing what, why, with whom? Because that's a different conversation than saying I'm starting at standard 401.3 and building a seminary around that. I think that is just extraordinary. And we don't know yet what's going to happen, right? But this spirit of collaboration and the idea of new ecologies forming, I think you also said something about the possibility that the ATS would become accessible in new ways to people who are non, quote unquote, not seeking accreditation in that way. Mm-hmm. So that their programs and services, which was the side of the house I was on, versus the accreditation side, which is the side you were on. But maybe people come in to the ATS and they get to choose. We actually need the programs and services. We don't need the accreditation in the same ways. I think I heard you say that.
And if I can say something about the nature of collaboration quickly, it has to be very intentional. It has to be very organic. It cannot just be a one event or two kind of experiments, but the commitment of trying to make things work out. And then it has to be solidary, especially in these times when resources are scarce all around. There should be a sense of solidarity. And let me say one more thing, too, in regards to Bible Institutes. Those who are getting certified for the sake of the quality of the programs, the level of the programs, have been under the shadow, at least half of them, of seminaries. Seminaries who have been willing to accompany and intentionally, organically, and in solidarity with this program, Bible Institutes, have worked with them. So here we have a field of opportunity for collaboration, not just with Bible Institutes, but certainly with all kinds of programs and initiatives for the training of leaders, which at the end is the mission that we all share in common. We want to train leaders for the sake of the church and for the sake of the world. And that's what matters at the end.
There comes that time in the conversation where you hear those words and you think, wow, that's a great place to end this. Precisely. But Fernando has pointed us in a very hopeful and generative direction. We are almost at the place where we could start a whole nother conversation. And that says that we have done a wonderful job with each other in this conversation, I think, today. It is also in that spirit that we can say to our listeners and to our guests, Dr. Drummond and Dr. Cascante, thank you for joining us. Thank you for stimulating these thoughts in new ways. Indeed, this is a very different conversation than any we've had previous to this one. And it's kind of a bridge in some ways, because it really does connect where we've been and where we're going and why it's so important for the future ahead of us. So we want to say thank you for all that you have given us to think about as we face a future of theological education. But we also realize, as I said, this conversation is by no means one and done over. In fact, it goes on. And I think hopefully, as our listeners are at the place of saying, boy, is this over? That it will indeed go over and continue in places that are robust and inquiring about the future of theological education. So thank you all. It's been a great afternoon.
Yes, thank you so much. It's been great being
You're
with
welcome.
You. Thanks for the wonderful conversation.
You're welcome.